The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, September 2019, Volume 20, Number 9. And this is the fourth of four installments this month. Gayle King shares this month's cover with Oprah. Both are wearing antique gold metallic sweater dresses. Gayle's is sleeveless with a crew neck, and Oprah's is long-sleeved with a stand-up collar. Gayle's layered haircut with its feathery bangs glows with soft caramel highlights, as does Oprah's shoulder-length, smooth and gently wavy cut. Their makeup is bronze and smoky with deep coral lipstick. This month's headline reads, "The Key to Lasting Friendship and Why Gayle and I Have It for Sure." The big wide O for Oprah Magazine sits on a gold rectangle in the upper left-hand corner of the cover. And let's start out with, from the Let's Eat section of the magazine, Fast or Fancy. And this month, we have a couple of different ways of preparing oatmeal. The whole grain staple doesn't have to be basic, as evidenced by this tricked-out tropical bowl from Darren Purcheese's book, Chef's Eat Breakfast Too. And we're looking down at the tops of four bowls of oatmeal, and they have skinny, it looks like maybe apple slices and bananas and pumpkin seeds. Let's read on and see. Zingy spices, tart passion fruit, and sweet banana bring big flavor, while freshly toasted coconut offers texture to ensure your start of the day is with a satisfying bite. Okay, so coconut, turmeric, and ginger oatmeal with passion fruit and banana. This makes four servings for a total time of 25 minutes, and this is the fancy version. In a small bowl, mix 1 tablespoon each of grated fresh turmeric and ginger, add 2 cups water, and set aside for 15 minutes or refrigerate overnight. Preheat oven to 325 degrees. In a medium saucepan, pour turmeric and ginger infusion. Add 1 1/4 cups of coconut milk, 2 cups of rolled oats, 2 tablespoons of honey or maple syrup, and seeds scraped from 1 vanilla bean split lengthwise. Over medium heat, bring to a simmer. Cook until mixture thickens, about 8 minutes. Remove from heat and stir in a pinch of salt. Line a baking sheet with parchment paper. Using a vegetable peeler, shave 20 to 30 thin slices from 1 fresh coconut, scattering them evenly on parchment. Bake until light golden brown, about 5 minutes. Divide oatmeal among 4 bowls and top with 1 banana sliced, 4 passion fruit halves scooped from 2 fruits, toasted coconut, and light dusting of ground cinnamon and ground ginger. And so there's a side note here. Purcheese says, this dish is just as good cold. Make it the day before, and if it's too gloppy in the morning from sitting in the fridge overnight, add a splash or two of milk. And so what looked like maybe thin apple slices are really very thin slices of fresh coconut. And the seeds are the vanilla bean seeds. And now, here's the fast version in the bag. For a briefer recipe that's just as bright and tasty, use 1/2 teaspoon each ground turmeric and ginger in place of fresh. Substitute 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract from the bean and rely on pre-toasted coconut flakes like Dang's lightly salted ones. They're $4 and go to dangfoods.com for stores. They're extra crunchy and have no added sugar. Sweet. And Niall will read Beauty Talk from the beautiful section of the magazine, and we have a picture of a smiling Reese Witherspoon. The actor and face of Elizabeth Arden shares the treatment she and her friends love. The massage she wants to send to young women, the message, and her favorite skincare tip. And there's a series of questions and answers. The first question, for a lot of women, beauty is a bonding experience. Is that true for you? And Reese's answer, absolutely. Every Tuesday, I used to go with my grandma when she'd get her hair done by Mr. Ray in Nashville. And I would listen to the women gossip and talk about what made them feel beautiful. It was empowering. They would have these conversations and feel ready to face the world. Question, what are the products or treatments that your inner circle is buzzing about right now? Reese's answer, facials, microcurrent facials, cryo facials. They've been a big part of our conversations lately. I did a cryo facial, which uses below freezing temperatures to help stimulate collagen production, with New York City celebrity esthetician Georgia Louise. And it was amazing. My skin looked fabulous for 7 days. Next question. What's the best beauty tip anyone's ever shared with you? She answers, when I was 18 years old, a makeup artist on a movie I was doing told me to apply sunscreen twice a day. She said, quote, you're going to be on camera for the rest of your life, so you have to take care of your skin, end of quote. Also, the more you sleep, the better you look. It might seem like fun to be out all night, but you'll look prettier if you stay home and go to bed. And the next question. For so long, beauty has been about making a woman look more alluring to a man. Does that notion need an update in our hashtag MeToo era? Reese's answer. I like to think of makeup as a self-confidence tool that allows you to put yourself together in a way that you find aesthetically pleasing. I've never really worn makeup to attract people. I think beauty is self-expression. It's like painting. My daughter is an artist and makes beautiful paintings, and she has similar feelings about makeup. We're about halfway through. Here's the next question. Speaking of your daughter, what do you think the message of beauty should be for girls today? The answer. For so many years, we've seen one standard of beauty reflected in the media, and I'm so glad my daughter's growing up in a moment when different women are expressing that they want to see themselves represented, and I think brands understand. Women are the ones buying the products, and we want to see all body types, all skin tones, and the entire spectrum of the female experience. Next question. Do you have any favorite budget beauty finds in skincare or makeup? And Reese's answer. Cetaphil face wash is very gentle and really great. I always travel with it. And the Revlon eyelash curler is fantastic. Next question. Which beauty products best express who you are today? Reese's answer. I'm loving the new Elizabeth Arden White Tea collection of fragrances. The vanilla orchid is one of my favorites. It makes me feel very grown up. And the final question. Do you think there's still an unfair amount of pressure put on women to appear a certain way as they age? And Reese's answer. Look, when I started in this business, I was told that after 40, I wouldn't be working very much. Now I'm 43 and working more than I ever have. So I think the standards are changing. People have more options with streaming platforms and can choose what they want to see. And they're saying, those are the types of women I want to see. Data is democratizing. And let's look at, on the sidebar here, the beauty products Reese is thinking about. The first two tall, skinny cylinders, one navy blue and one white, Beauty Counter Daily Shampoo and Conditioner, $26 each, beautycounter.com. Reese says, I like Beauty Counter Shampoo and Conditioner because it's a clean brand. And then we have the Revlon Eyelash Curler at $6. And you can find that at Ulta.com. The Cetaphil Gentle Skin Cleanser, $11 at drugstores. It's in a white plastic pump bottle. And then in a tall, skinny, clear rectangle is Elizabeth Arden White Tea Vanilla Orchid Perfume. Oh, Detoile Spray, $56 for 3.3 ounces, ElizabethArden.com. And then below that, a tall, clear cylinder with a rose gold cap and rose gold little pods inside. Elizabeth Arden Retinol Ceramide Capsules Line Erasing Night Serum, $84 for 60 pieces at ElizabethArden.com. Reese says, the Elizabeth Arden Retinol Capsules are part of my nighttime routine now. When I use them, I feel like I'm really taking care of myself. And still in the beautiful section of the magazine, we have four real women modeling their afros. Afromations is the title. Since the 60s, the afro has been a symbol of power, purpose, and pride. Now, with the resurgence of the natural hair movement, the look is taking center stage again. Four women sporting fabulous fros share the deeply personal ways their iconic hairstyle continues to send a message. And there is definitely a very 1960s and 70s look to these stunning haircuts. And the first woman has a very tall afro so that it's shaped, you know, almost like in a sphere, and the sphere ends at her jawline. So it's really kind of tapered in around her face. So that her chin's a little bit lower than the afro, but it's so tall on top, maybe 6 inches or 7 inches. And it's off her forehead, and she has these beautiful arched eyebrows and very soft makeup. She's in a metallic gold turtleneck sweater, and she's holding the neckline up, and she's got her hands up at her chin line, her wrists together in front of her, and large gold jewelry rings on her fingers, and she's looking straight at us. This is Ebony Davis, model and activist. She says, when I walk into a room with my afro, I'm taking up space as a black woman. I've earned that space. I claim that space. In November 2015, Ebony Davis had an awakening. After tapping into the natural hair community online, she decided to quit the relaxers. Some people in her work circle weren't happy. Davis recalls, quote, they said, Your rolled out of the bed hair isn't going to work. Clients aren't going to want to book you, end of quote. Davis chose to ignore the warning, and within a month of going natural, she booked the biggest campaign of her career with Calvin Klein, in which she wore a resplendent fro. Her commitment to showing up in the way she feels most comfortable is the kind of authenticity the afro represents, says celebrity hairstylist Felicia Leatherwood. In today's fashion and beauty industries, the afro is not only accepted but celebrated. Leatherwood notes, quote, fros have more texture and definition now. People are adorning them with headbands, faux flowers, and satin wraps. It's a beautiful thing to see. And next we have the actor Danae Benton. And her afro is kind of long in the back so that it touches the back of her neck and comes almost to the shoulder, the back of the shoulders. And we look at a side profile of her. But hers is very long and big as well. It's just not tapered at the chin line, and she's wearing this very slinky dark red jersey dress with a high neckline and a cutout that goes from the neckline over to the side to the underarm. It has long skinny sleeves, and it's bunched up and gathered on one side in the front. Danae says, I try to always wear my hair natural on red carpets so black girls can feel represented. She says, quote, in high school, I learned about Eurocentric beauty standards and black self-loathing, and it blew my mind, end of quote. The idea of other young black girls feeling less than because of the images of beauty reflected back at them on TV wasn't something Benton could abide. Her answer was to proudly, unequivocally embrace her hair's natural texture. It's what the Afro has been about for decades. Quote, during the 1960s, the style was a rejection of a traditional European look and a way to embrace one's African heritage, end of quote, says Alelia Bundles, hair historian, author, and great-great-granddaughter of hair care pioneer Madam C.J. Walker. She goes on to say, quote, it was about self-love and self-affirmation, end of quote. Benton, who plays Eliza Hamilton in the Broadway production of Hamilton, which gloriously crossed racial boundaries by casting mostly people of color to play key figures in American history, now recognizes the magnitude of her decision to wear her hair natural. She says, quote, growing up, I hardly ever got to see a dark-skinned black woman with natural hair at the center of an incredible story, love story, like this, end of quote. The truth is, many young people who wear their hair natural are still marginalized today. In recent years, students sporting certain hairstyles, afros, braids, twists, locks, have been targeted by school administrations. One young girl was even threatened with expulsion if she didn't cut off her hair, which was deemed a, quote, a distraction, end of quote, to her classmates. Benton wants better for the next generation and thinks that as more prominent women wear their hair natural, perceptions will change. And finally, she says, quote, I hope tomorrow's 18-year-olds have an easier time, end of quote. And our next model with a gray, with an afro is Marsha Cook, an SVP content strategy and community Vice Media. And hers is kind of a medium afro, and it's gray. And she's a tall, slender woman. And she is wearing a mauve ribbed sweater dress. It's sleeveless, and it has some funky little beading on the sleeves and the neckline. And she says, my fro gives me superpowers. It's been 15 years since Marsha Cook set aside silk presses and braids and began to adopt the style that's become her signature. But although she's in her happy hair space now, truly loving her texture took time. Despite little resistance from her colleagues and managers in corporate America, Cook still straightened her hair for events where she felt that would be better received. Cook says, quote, I was hearing the voices of my traditional Jamaican parents. I think they saw straight hair as a ticket into the world they wanted for me, end of quote. Rather than being celebrated, naturally textured hair has often been something women felt the need to hide in the workplace. Bundles says, quote, the Afro in particular has always threatened the status quo. For a very long time, it made corporations and white employers nervous about what they perceived as militancy, end of quote. But that's starting to change. Earlier this year, the Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair, CROWN Act, which prohibits employers and schools from discriminating against natural hairstyles, was enacted into California law. For more information, we'll see this little bar down below that says Stand Up for Natural Hair. As for Cook, she didn't truly understand her hair's impact until she moved into her role at Vice Media. Younger staffers will sometimes raise their fist or give her a round of applause when she walks through the office. And their voices give her hope that perceptions have changed since her parents' day. She says, quote, millennials come into my office and talk about my hair and really convey a sense of pride about who I am and what I've achieved as a member of senior management. That's a real evolution, end of quote. And now, here's the footnote about Stand Up for Natural Hair. You can help end bias based on hair texture and hair styles by supporting the Crown Coalition. Co-founded by Dove, this alliance is working to outlaw hair discrimination in the workplace and in schools. Visit thecrownact.com to sign the online petition and build momentum to pass the Crown Act nationwide. And finally, we have Rose Marie Ingleton, MD, a dermatologist. And she has a really short afro and hoop earrings, and she's wearing a black ribbed stand-up collar sweater. She says, "My afro makes me feel free, light, and liberated." Dr. Rose Marie Ingleton has been rocking the TWA, Teeny Weeny Afro, since the early 90s, when she was one of only two women of color in her dermatology residency. Unexpectedly, the style has been a doctoring boon to Ingleton. Numerous patients have come to her for help for thinning hair, stemming from years of weave wearing, tight braids, dome dryers, hot combs, and flat irons. All of these techniques and the tools can have long-term consequences, as New York City hairstylist Dickey, who styled all four women in this story. When patients dealing with those consequences come to Ingleton for her medical expertise, they discover she has even more to offer. Ingleton says, quote, "They're asking me how they can make the transition to wearing their hair in an afro like mine. These conversations can be emotional because they deal with the psychology of why we do these things to our hair. But I'm an optimist. I focus on what options are available, and I'm always so thrilled to share some of what I've got with people." End of quote. And now let's read an article entitled "The Color of Money: The Particular Financial Stress of Being Young, Professional, Female, and Black" by Erica Stallings. It was an enviable dilemma. Two galas on the same night. Luckily, they were at the same place, Manhattan's gleaming, glass-paneled Time Warner Center. First stop, the fourth floor, for a party raising money for school reading programs. Tickets cost $1,000 a head for a cocktail reception in a lounge with sweeping views of Central Park. I wore a one-shoulder black Tahari dress and strappy Stuart Weitzman heels. On arrival, I was greeted by an acquaintance known to make five-figure gifts to the organization. After some small talk about summer plans, mine, a rental house with friends in Montauk, the Long Island fishing village that's become more swanky than shanty. Malia Obama celebrated her 19th birthday there a couple of summers ago. I tucked my Ferragamo clutch under my arm and rode the elevator up to the second event. Also, $1,000 a ticket. This one supported a charter school network. More canapes, more champagne, more celebrities. Hi, Katie Couric. Although I was one of very few black faces in the crowd, I was pretty sure my polished appearance, my degrees from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Georgetown Law, and my career as an attorney signified that I was just like everyone else. I dressed the part, I talked the part. With my Narciso Rodriguez perfume, I even spelled the part. But here was the reality. A mentor had covered the price of my admission to both events. I attended UNC on a scholarship that included a stipend for living expenses. To complete my JD, I borrowed $100,000. The designer perfume, which has been my signature scent, was a gift from a friend who works in fashion. Those $250 Stuart Weitzman heels, I'd frantically charged them a decade earlier after a corporate head of diversity pulled me aside at a networking event to warn that my $80 flats would be held against me. And the whole time I was chatting about Montauk, I was fretting about my budget. Specifically, the $400 I'd just promised to lend a relative in need. Even though I make six figures and have a plum job in the Big Apple, I am like many black women in the sense that my family wasn't able to launch me financially into the world. It's simply not in our experience. In so many cases, we've had to work harder to get where we are. Once we get here, we have to work harder to stay. There's a lot riding on our success. People are counting on us. And so we live with the unsettling sense that with the slightest tug, our carefully conceived plans for success could instantly unravel. I'm 33 years old. No matter how much I achieve, it never feels like enough. And in many ways, it isn't enough to pay off my student debt, buy a home, amass the kind of retirement funds I should have by now. Yet in the eyes of my rural North Carolina family, I have achieved the American dream. Anne Price has heard countless stories like mine, from professional black women who are exhausted from sprinting just to stay in the middle of the pack, a policy analyst who spent the past 8 years at the head of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in Oakland. Price says, quote, "I'm listening and nodding my head because what you're describing, first-generation college student, professionally successful, still struggling to keep yourself and your family afloat, is so common. It really speaks to the issue of why race, and not just class, is so important to understand financial stability and well-being," end of quote. Price, now also president of the Insight Center, points out that more and more black women are pursuing college degrees, the most important move we can make to secure a place in the middle class, or so we're told. 26% have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, up from 20% a decade ago. Yet we're running into two major roadblocks, says Price. Quote, "The first is that it's really hard to build wealth when you don't have it passed down to you," end of quote. Among college-educated black families, the average amount of inheritance, including cash, home, and other assets, is under $40,000, compared with over $150,000 for college-educated white families, according to a 2018 study in the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. About 87% of those black families receive less than $10,000, as opposed to about 59% of the white families. The second roadblock, says Price, is that black women are more likely to find themselves taking care of family members financially. Quote, "This strips away about 27% of a black family's wealth," she's, quote, end of quote, she notes. "It also forces some hard accounting." Quote, "The choice is, what do I do? Pay off my student loan? Start to save for retirement? Put away money for my child's education? I can't do all three and take care of parents or siblings," end of quote. My white professional peers don't really get this. When I recently mentioned to one of them that I was considering taking on a second job as an adjunct professor to pay for my eventual wedding, she chided me for doomsday thinking. Easy for her to say when her parents had come up with $50,000 for her nuptials. Many of my white classmates have already paid off their student loans, if they had any, and are starting to purchase homes. A white friend from law school recently lamented her inability to find a satisfactory New York City apartment in her budget, which is $1 million. Even white people of more modest means might have parents who could take out a loan for a wedding, or help with a down payment on a house, or at least serve as a guarantor for an apartment. It's disheartening to know your family can't. As my friend Maya, a black media professional in Washington, D.C., could tell you, quote, "We're super smart and accomplished and have degrees, and yet we're still doggy paddling. Sometimes I go on Facebook and look at the profiles of white people from my high school, and they're visibly rolling in dough. We're doing good things. It's just that the gulf between them and me is so striking," end of quote. I was raised by a single mother who worked full-time as a secretary and never made more than $25,000 a year. A heart attack had forced my grandmother to retire from nursing before she turned 40. But somehow, through a combination of loans, credit cards, and putting in extra hours, she and my mother managed to cover our bills. When I received my first law firm bonus back in 2012, $10,000 before taxes, a dizzying amount to me then, I had already earmarked a portion for my mom to help her make a down payment on a new car. I now keep a separate savings account for unexpected family expenses and regularly send money home. Although at 54, my mom is relatively young and putting aside money for her retirement, I'm already worrying that I'll need to find extra funds to cover shortfalls. I'm right to be concerned. Married black women age 60 and older with a bachelor's degree have only $424,000 in median wealth, all assets including cash, but minus debts. Their white counterparts have $778,000, according to researchers from Duke University and the Insight Center. Sending money to our parents is something 45% of college-educated black households do, says a 2017 study in the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis Review. Only 16% of college-educated white households do the same. Take Hannah, whose story will sound familiar to many black women my age. Hannah always knew her family was working class. Her parents had immigrated to the U.S. from Ethiopia and were raising four children primarily on her father's salary. She was accepted to several prestigious universities. She decided on Dartmouth because of its generous financial aid package. At school, she juggled work-study jobs at a call center, the library, and an administrative office. She says, quote, "I didn't want to add more tension by asking my parents for money," end of quote. As soon as Hannah graduated and started working at a nonprofit, she began using part of her limited income to help with one-off expenses like a new computer. She now has a better-paying job in media, but over the past few years, family obligations have become an even larger percentage of her monthly budget. Since her dad's health forced him into partial retirement in 2018, bills have been piling up. Hannah sends spending money to her siblings, two of whom are still in college, and pays for part of her mother's tuition in a master's program. The expense that stresses her out the most, though, is the credit cards. She says, quote, "There was a significant period during which my mom stopped working in order to care for the four of us, and she used credit cards to make up the shortfall. The interest penalty is really high, so paying that off has become my main priority," end of quote. Hannah is hoping to save for a down payment on a home of her own after her family's credit cards are paid off, after her mom gets her master's, after her siblings graduate and find jobs. The obligation to help relatives as much and as soon as possible can taint our relationships with them. An African-American professor I know says she doesn't mind providing financial assistance to her mother, but she does feel uneasy about the way it's changed their dynamic. She says, quote, "I don't go shopping with her anymore because I know she'll ask me to pay for things," end of quote. She also thinks twice before sharing success stories with her family. She says, quote, "I once won an award for $10,000, and my mom's reaction was, 'How much are you going to give me?'" End of quote. Angela Neal Barnett, PhD, a psychological science professor at Kent State who runs a program called Sisters Offering Support, SOS, which facilitates meetups for black professional women who may be experiencing anxiety, says, quote, "There is definitely stress associated with the expectation that you'll be able to provide. Many grew up as the golden child, so their family looks to them to take care of everything. Even in childhood and adolescence, many black women were placed in a caregiving role. Once they get into the workforce, especially if they have the fancy job like attorney or doctor, it's expected that they will step up. If a person dies, you're to pay for the funeral. If someone gets in trouble, you're to pay the bill. Extended family members see you as the bank. I work with SOS participants to help them set a budget with a line item for requests from relatives, if that's what they want," end of quote, says Neal Barnett, author of Soothe Your Nerves, The Black Woman's Guide to Understanding and Overcoming Anxiety, Panic, and Fear. Sometimes the allocations are for the entire family. Some are broken out per person. Either way, she stresses the importance of staying within budget, even if the requests keep coming. She says, quote, "We help people realize that saying no to a loved one does not make you a bad person," end of quote. The main lesson, pay yourself first. This can be hard to internalize, though. It was my therapist who helped me recognize something that's been stoking my financial anxiety. No one in my immediate family has gained a foothold in the middle class. As Valerie Jarrett, former advisor to President Obama, likes to say, you can't be what you can't see. I'm the first to attend college, let alone law school, and I have no role models showing me how I'm supposed to do everything I want to do, as well as everything that's expected of me. In many ways, I am the role model. Education is supposed to be our ticket, yet even here, black women are stuck in a hole. The 2019 report, Deeper in Debt, Women in Student Loans, published by the American Association of University Women, found that black women amass an average debt load of $30,366 by college graduation, compared with $21,993 for white women and $19,486 for white men. The same AAUW paper noted that after graduation, black women struggle the most with repayments. 57% reported being unable to afford all essential expenses while dealing with student loans. According to a recent report from the liberal think tank Demos, the typical white male borrower has paid off 44% of his loan balance 12 years after beginning college, while the typical black female borrower has seen her student loan grow by an additional 13% within the same period. 45% of black female borrowers who started college in 2003 defaulted on a loan within 12 years, compared with only 20% of white female borrowers. The report noted the double bind faced by black people, quote, "As we have slowly made progress opening the college gates over the past four decades, black students are far more likely to borrow than white students and borrow in higher amounts. Students of color are contending with an increasingly expensive higher education system against the backdrop of centuries in which black and brown people have been intentionally shut out of the ability to build wealth and pass it along to future generations. In other words, many students are not just borrowing against their future, but borrowing because of the past," end of quote. Those loans can feel like shackles. According to the Duke and Insight researchers, the median wealth of a single black woman in her 20s with a bachelor's degree is minus $11,000, meaning that her debts are $11,000 more than her assets and savings. For married black women in their 30s with a bachelor's, it's minus $20,500. In contrast, a married white woman in her 30s with the same degree has a median wealth of $97,000. Even more shocking, single white women without a college degree have $3,000 more in median wealth than single black women with a bachelor's degree. Then there's the crushing fact that black women are, as a rule, underpaid. We typically earn only 68 cents for every dollar paid to a white man, while white women earn 79 cents. And according to the 2018 Women in the Workplace survey conducted by McKinsey and Company, for every 100 men promoted to manager, only 60 black women are promoted. Black women account for less than 1% of partners at law firms, according to the National Association for Law Placement. On top of this, many black female employees are forced into the de facto role of, quote, diversity ambassador, end of quote, which involves extra work to make our offices less hostile for other black employees, often for zero additional compensation, overtime, or bonus. Adia Wingfield, Ph.D., a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis, says, quote, "Black workers are having to navigate environments where companies say they want more diversity but aren't putting resources or support into achieving that, end of quote. Wingfield's forthcoming book, Flatlining, Race, Work, and Healthcare in the New Economy, explores how the healthcare industry in particular relies heavily on Black employees to do the extra labor required to make their organizations and services more accessible to communities of color. She says, quote, organizations are engaging in what I call racial outsourcing. They leave the actual work of creating diversity to the Black professionals and rely on those employees to make workplaces more welcoming and supportive for people of color, end of quote. Black women are often caught in a catch-22 because, quote, they want to be supportive of colleagues of color, but at the same time, the extra support work isn't usually compensated, end of quote. Many of the women Wingfield interviewed said they were aware their employers were taking advantage of their willingness to be helpful. Danielle, a friend of a friend, was working as a litigation associate at a New Jersey law firm when she was asked to serve on a task force to create a diversity website and publication for the firm. Although she was honored to be part of the project, quote, when you work at a law firm where there's such an emphasis on billable hours, diversity work detracts from the billable tasks. Yet, that's how the firm valuates associates, end of quote. Almost everyone asked to serve on the task force was a minority. Danielle didn't feel that she could say no. Quote, it would not have been looked well upon if I had declined to participate, end of quote. The project involved significant time and intellectual labor, none of which she feels was factored into her raises or annual bonuses. Even when our companies don't overtly put that kind of pressure on us, we put it on ourselves. Last summer, when I realized that one of my firm's interns was a Black student who had just finished his first year at Howard University School of Law, I immediately decided to take him under my wing. As the only Black attorney in my department, I felt responsible for making sure he succeeded at the internship, introducing him to other potential mentors, and connecting him with resources. After he expressed concern about his chances of landing a corporate law firm position for the following summer, I sprang into action, setting up informational interviews with partners and senior in-house counsel who'd be in a position to leverage their network on his behalf. Over the next 8 weeks, I took him out for countless coffees and almost daily lunches. We even went to a few legal galas. This was satisfying work that I wanted to do. One of my mantras is that it's okay to be the first, but it's not okay to be the last. But in hindsight, I recognize that some of that time could have been better spent on projects that might lead to a promotion, and in turn a higher salary and a faster payoff of my law school debt. It's frustrating that this extra labor is something most of my white counterparts don't have to think about doing or feel guilty about not doing. Every time I go to a professional conference, there's a panel on wealth building, and the advice is usually something like, invest in venture capital. When I asked Anne Price for her opinion on the best way forward, she said the conversation needs to shift from personal responsibility to more systemic fixes. She says, quote, the bootstrap narrative, in which we tell people that hard work is the best path to success, diverts us from what really landed us in this position and puts the onus on the individual to haul herself out of it. But Black women are already doing everything this country has told them is important to build a good and dignified life. What we need to do is change the system, end of quote. That would mean new sweeping policies like erasing student loans or subsidizing real estate down payments and closing costs for people in neighborhoods historically discriminated against by lenders. It's encouraging that presidential candidates are already talking about these ideas. We'll likely hear even more as the 2020 election approaches. In the meantime, while I'm doing everything I can to increase my net worth, I'm also trying to change the way I evaluate my self-worth. Not long ago, I told my therapist about a recurring nightmare of struggling to climb to the top of a mountain, only to have a large shoe appear and kick me to the bottom. I didn't need a mental health professional to explain that this represents my fear of falling back into the poverty of my childhood. But I did require her help in dealing with the near constant concern it's been causing me lately. She encouraged me to stop blaming myself for what I haven't accomplished and focus instead on what I have. She also gave me a few useful tips. I now write down small achievements, such as hitting my savings goal for the month or paying off a credit card balance, and refer to them when I get discouraged. I try to remind myself that I can ask for help from a boss or a friend or a financial planner, and to find my own inspiring role models. I'm developing relationships with older Black women attorneys who share how they've made it to the top and how they've managed their disillusionment with the system. All very helpful, right? And it cost me only $400, the out-of-pocket price of a month's worth of counseling. And now let's go to the reading room and read this month's long story short. This is a one-page essay, if you will, from an author. And the author this month is Aaron Summers, who wrote Stay Up with Hugo Best. Reaching for the Star, Aaron Summers on Navigating Adulthood and a Minor Celebrity Over One Misspent Stint in L.A. My closest brush with fame occurred in Los Angeles in summer 2009 when I had a friend who knew a famous actress. I was not in the actress's entourage. I was adjacent. Adjacent to people adjacent to fame is a very L.A. designation. I was 24 and had moved from New York that spring to become a screenwriter. How I would do this, I did not know. Whenever the question was put to me by my parents, I would reply that I was young and full of promise and would figure it out. That proved difficult. I lived in a beige apartment on a desolate stretch of Venice Boulevard with a balcony covered in birdshit. I drove an early 2000s Chrysler Sebring convertible, lusterless gray, loaned to me by a friend's parents for $50 a month. I took a job at J. Crew. I couldn't afford to park in the nearby garage on Wilshire, but a coworker taught me that it closed at 11 p.m., at which point the arm went up for the night. If you could wait that long, you didn't have to pay. So every day I lingered after my shift, sometimes for hours. Mostly, I read in my car. That's what life was like when I met the actress. An acquaintance from college invited me to a house party in Mar Vista. I walked in and saw the actress, more beautiful in real life, in spiky heels and leather leggings. She was small, especially her head. It impressed me with its smallness. It seemed like one could easily palm it. She was flanked by her entourage, including another of my college friends, whom I'll call Kelsey. Around them, in concentric rings, stood everyone else. I entered the outermost ring and watched. Kelsey and the actress were playing beer pong. It was the actress's first time. Kelsey had grown up with the actress and now lived rent-free in her mansion in the valley. She traveled with the actress, rode in her car. She even looked a little like the actress, same manner of dress, hair, diminutive stature. In fact, all three women in the entourage looked like lesser versions of the actress. Her, but diluted. Kelsey introduced me to her, an unremarkable exchange of pleasantries. Then the actress left and the party instantly died. There were many more parties at that house. A few times I watched the sun come up over the stucco lip of the second floor balcony, remembering with horror that J. Crew awaited. All that featherweight cashmere to fold. Occasionally, the actress showed up. More often, she wouldn't materialize. When she was around, the room reoriented in her direction, drinking games springing up for her benefit. I was unable to distinguish myself. I didn't know how. Others did. My friend Anna swung an invite to a club once and ended up in the same car as the actress, her entourage, and Khloe Kardashian. But the car was too full, and Anna was asked to ride in the trunk. She moved back to New York soon after. In the end, Kelsey was ousted by another girl through a series of machinations and wedge drivings so effective that Kelsey moved out of the actress's house and their friendship evaporated. To me, the social acuity it took to pull that off was an opaque piece of technology, like an internet router. I could have stared at it forever and still not grasped how it worked. I felt superior to those who possessed it. They were conniving, obsequious, but I also saw how the actress's sparkle stuck to them. They didn't seem lonely, whereas I was, hugely and transparently. That was the reason I went to those parties in the first place. It was terrible to stay out late and then stand in a store for 8 hours. At the end of summer, I went hungover to an early meeting. They were teaching theft prevention strategies. We role-played saying code words into our walkie-talkies. My customer, Rob, needs help up front. I found myself rooting for Rob. Let Rob take a stack of gingham and resell it to cover rent or his car payment. Have a nice meal. I had been up all night. My hands shook. My eyeballs felt dry. I imagined my brain was cracked terrain in a stock photo depicting drought. No serotonin for miles. "Can I take a break?" I asked the manager. He said I could have a 15-minute break in 4 hours. I thought about how the actress could sit whenever. I left and never went back. The final party was at the Hollywood Hills mansion of a girl I'd met a few times who never remembered my name. The actress and her entourage arrived. Butt-cheek shorts, cropped moto jackets, so much flat-ironed hair. Best selves were summoned. The evening had not been fun, but now we could pretend it had been. Someone set up flip cup next to the pool. Line up, chug your beer, flip your cup. The first team to flip all their cups wins. I found myself next to the actress on the same team. Here was my chance. I turned and said, "Have you played before?" I knew the answer. She shook her head. "I didn't go to college." I lost the game for us. I could not flip that cup while standing next to a famous person. I could not flip that cup, probably even alone. L.A. was the cup, and I could not flip it. I moved back east. The actress never became a megastar. Time passes, and we're supposed to take some lesson from it. But I can't figure out what. I already knew when I moved to L.A. that fame cannot sustain us. Not someone else's, not in any substantial way. It cannot warm us. I knew that. Everyone does. But still, we hold our hands up to the flame. And here's a review of the book Inland by Taya Obrant. Inland, Taya Obrant's mordantly imaginative new novel, comprises two stories that do not exactly intertwine but run like rivers in view of each other, sometimes crossing, headed toward a remote meeting point. The first concerns an immigrant known as Lori, who begins as an abandoned child and becomes, in the opening pages, first an errand boy for a collector of corpses, then a body thief, then a conduit for the dead and a pickpocket, then an accidental murderer, after which he goes on the lam. Eventually, he ends up a cameleer, that is, in charge of one of a number of camels brought to Texas for their ability to transport enormous weights long distances without stopping for water. Mingled with Lori's tale is an account of just over 24 eventful hours in the life of Nora Lark, a frontierswoman in Arizona Territory in 1893. Nora has three living sons, one talkative dead daughter, a silent grandmother, a ward with a spiritualist bent, a missing husband, and a literal constant thirst. Lori's sections are rollicking and full of movement. Nora's sprawl in the manner of great landscape paintings. This is a desert story rendered in technicolor. Obrant is the kind of writer who can forever change the way you think about a thing just through her powers of description. One scene in which the residents of a small Texas town empty their houses to see how much a camel might carry haunts me still. and she can snap your head back with an aphorism. Quote, I have come to understand that extraordinary people are eroded by their worries, while the useless are carried ever forward by their delusions, end of quote, says Lori. And who alive today could argue? Inland is an ambitious and beautiful work with many things. Immigration, the afterlife, responsibility, guilt, marriage, parenthood, revenge, all the roads and waterways that led to America. Miraculously, it's also a page-turner and a mystery, as well as a love letter to a camel. And like a camel, improbable and splendid, something to happily puzzle over at first and take your breath away at the end. And to wrap up this installment, let's go back to January 2017 and listen to this from Remember the Dear Lisa column. Dear Lisa, why do I always have to be the one to tell friends when they've got food stuck in their teeth? Is it okay just to ignore it? Elka, Delaware. Oh, Elka. What I am about to say, I say in the most loving way possible. Grow up. As a woman who recently went 5 straight hours with what appeared to be an entire leg of lamb wedged in her gum, I'm putting everyone who remained silent in my time of need on notice. I will find you, and I will send Liam Neeson to make you watch Taken 3. The rule is simple. If you see something, say something. And another one, Dear Lisa, Alice, my 10-year-old, wants to pick her own clothes, but her taste leaves a lot to be desired. And Lisa says, first of all, paisley and plaid must be the navy blue of somewhere. Second, you're asking advice from a woman whose daughter spent kindergarten rocking a pillbox hat and oven mitts. I figure my kid has her whole life to dress for success, so for now, she gets permission to play. However, for special occasions, you still have veto power. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.